Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Hip Hop Saved My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back, because it's time for the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. I am joined by comedian Tiernan Duyeb. How are you doing, Tiernan?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, man. And that was well pronounced, thanks.
Thank you very much. We were just talking before we started recording about, I know how to say your name, but when it's about to be recorded, I don't know, I feel pressure. Do you know what I mean? And then we're talking about, where was it that we first met?
I might be wrong, but I'm sure it was like this little gig at some, like, university in East Anglia or something.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. Yeah, it was, I remember you were hosting, and it was one of those gigs where they weren't sure what to do, and so I remember you helping them out on how to set the room up and stuff like that, because which is obviously above and beyond your remit as a host, but yeah. I remember you stepping in and sorting their gig out for them.
It's so depressing how often that happens, though, where you kind of turn up to do a gig and go, oh, you don't actually know how to run it. Oh, I see. Right, you've got all the chairs facing the wrong way and you haven't got any lights, and somehow people are meant to hear us even though they're in another room or something.
I know. And then you have like this decision to make about whether you just go along with it and have a dreadful gig, or actually step in and look like you're above your station by asking them to sort stuff out. Because if you have a terrible gig, they won't go, oh, that's because we didn't arrange the room properly. They'll go, it's because these people are rubbish. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, a bit of a dilemma.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, without sort of revealing how shallow I am as a person, it often depends on how much they're paying for me. If they're paying enough, then I'll arrange the room for them. Sure, I'll add that into what I do as a job.
What have you been up to? What are you up to at the moment?
I'm about to stop doing stuff because it's nearly Christmas, but been doing... do you know what? Because I sort of sussed a thing a few years ago, because I co-run a comedy club for kids, which is stand-up for children, six families. And a few years back, I realised I can avoid all the horrible adult Christmas gigs full of office dues if I did a Christmas show with Howard Reed and Beck Hill instead. So we deal with sugared-up children and make them get angry that we don't know anything about Christmas, and that's much better to deal with, actually.
Well, I've done a couple of these kids gigs that you run, and they're always like, for a comedian, they're always terrifying to think about before you do your first one. And I think I did one in Edinburgh, and I think Ian Sterling was hosting. This is years ago, like, I think he might be my first Edinburgh, and it was great. I mean, like, you think you're gonna have to, like, not dumb it down, but, you know, the trap you can fall into is thinking, oh, I've got to be super kiddy and, like, be a bit patronising or whatever. But actually, they listen to material and laugh, right? I mean, they're a great audience.
They're brilliant. And also, I mean, I spend a lot of my time just winding them up because it's really fun. So did a show today where I insisted that I had an advent calendar, but it was just one big door. And every day I open it, there's a pavement outside and cars and trees. And they're all screaming, going, that's your front door. And I'm like, no, it's my advent calendar. It's got a number on it, 36. And they lose their shit. And it's brilliant, you know. It's just sort of the one time as an adult you can make children really angry, you know, in a valid way. It's brilliant.
Now, we spoke to your brother, The Last Skeptic, on this podcast, and he says, and you can back up or contradict what he's saying, but he says you are the reason he got into hip-hop, pretty much. Like, you are the nerdy hip-hop fan out of the two of them. Is that true?
Yeah, the thing is, do you know what the problem is? Is I was, and he's got better at it than me because it's his job. Right. And I think there was definitely a period in my life when I first started gigging where I lost all hip-hop knowledge because you have no social life gigging every night. And and he kind of excelled in front of me, and I've been jealous of him ever since.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because there is so much stuff coming out that I can't remember the first time it happened, but I'm conscious of like a period of time, and this is partly to do with getting older, but also just not having the time, as you said, where people will mention like four or five artists and you go, I haven't got a fucking clue about any of those people that you just named, man. Like, it's a horrible feeling.
It's really, also, like, I don't know how you feel, but with like downloading music, like when I use CDs or whatever of like a hip hop album, I would listen to it 12, 13 times. I'd know all the names of the tracks, I'd know all the lyrics. Now I've downloaded about four or five things recently and I haven't really had time to listen to any of them. I can't remember what any of them are called. Like, it's just sort of, I remember that one beat that I quite like and I just feel so fucking clueless with it all. It's such a shame. It's like, yeah, I know like five people that are at the moment.
I know, and it's mad. And the other thing is, it's like, it's sort of like listening to music online, like Spotify and all that, has made things better in terms of you can find artists straight away. But it's made things worse in terms of you treat things more disposably. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I, like the new Hobson album just came out and I listened to it once to sort of form an opinion. And then I sort of haven't had time to listen to it again. Whereas, like, you know, before, if an artist I was excited about came with an album, like you said, I'd be, like, smashing that, like, three or four times a day and memorising it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's such a different experience listening to music now.
Yeah, so I went to see, beginning of last week, I went to see The Gorillaz live, which was amazing.
I heard that was incredible.
They supported them. Oh, man, it was like, do you know... what was brilliant is there were so many guests, but also Damon Albarn didn't introduce any of them, so I didn't know who any of them were. And like, Mos Def was on, right? But he had his face in, he had a flat cap on and a hood up, and I was sort of sitting quite high up at the O2 and I couldn't quite see it, and it sounded like him, but I'm like, is that someone else being him? And then I got home and went, I've just seen Mos Def do two tracks and I didn't realise. Like, I felt kind of gutted about it. And Booty Brown came on and did the Dirty Harry track or whatever, and I didn't realise, I haven't seen Booty Brown in years, so I didn't realise that was him. So I came home and had to look up who I'd just watched, which was ridiculous. So I found, like, the whole way, I noticed there was definitely a point when I've got older, because there were so many Gorillaz tracks. I was like, I know the words to this, I know the name of that track, I know the words to this one. And then it was all like the recent album and the one before, I was like, I know this, but I can't remember what it is, where it's from.
Yeah, that is horrible. It's even like, have you seen this... have you seen this Thomas the Tank Engine Biggie remix thing, right? So it took me, it was such a weird experience for me because I sort of didn't remember the tune, like the Biggie tune. Like, I didn't know, I couldn't remember the title of it for a few seconds, like maybe 30 seconds. And I was watching it, but I knew all the words to the verse. And I was like, it was like my brain was functioning in like a really weird way. It's horrible, man.
Release the brainstorm to make your motherfucking brain warm. A strange form, something kind of lyrical. Biggie the bastard, so that's kind of spiritual. Well, in God we trust, guns are bust. Stop that disgusting, suicide something. And do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things that I bring?
It's funny you say about that Gorillaz gig, is I went to see Nas and Lauryn Hill recently out in LA, and it was, Nas was amazing. And then Lauryn Hill came out and everybody lost their minds because obviously you hardly ever see Lauryn Hill doing anything.
Did and she like, turn up on time had, as well?
Yeah, she was on time. She had a full band. Wow. She looked sort of like a hip hop Nora Batty, is sort of the best way to describe, like, her outfit.
It Nora was, Beattie,
yeah, it was mad. And then, but then, like, she started singing, and I guess it's because she hasn't done that much stuff, but like, she just started doing like weird remixes of all her stuff because obviously she's bored of the original versions, right? So it was like all the vocal, so you'd recognize the words, but you wouldn't recognize a tune or whatever. And I remember standing there, and like, people around me were like excited and stuff, and I was sort of thinking, I don't know if I like this, man. Like, I sort of want to hear the songs that I know. And then I had to go back home, or as I was leaving the gig, I had to check Twitter to see what my opinion of, if my opinion of the gig was appropriate. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so mad when you read a review and you go, oh, right, yeah. And also the other thing, similar to what you just said, like, Puff came out for, like, Nas did Hate Me Now, and then he came out, but it just, we were so far away, you sort of didn't want to be racist and just assume that the black fella in the sunglasses and tracksuit was Diddy. But then he started doing the signature dance move, you know, that sort of looking down, shuffling across the stage kind of thing. He did that. And I was
with
like,
his
oh,
arms
yeah.
kind of, yeah, 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 yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think there's a concert etiquette as well, isn't there? Like a few years back, I saw Missy at, I think it was like the O2 Wireless in Hyde Park or whatever. And I was really excited. I'd never seen Missy live before. And she came out, she did like 3 tracks of her new album. Then she brought out someone else, someone called like Tweety or something, some newer person that like lasted a single and then disappeared. And then right. Missy disappeared. This person did 5 tracks. Then Missy came back on and did a medley of her best songs, doing only like a verse from each, and then left. And I was like, that's not, no one wanted that. No one wanted what you've done. Just, you know, give the people at least one track fully that they like.
Here's a little bit that you like to pull. How did you get into hip hop?
Right, listen, I need to ask you, how did you first get into hip hop? Like, what was your first sort of record that made you realise that you loved it?
Do you know, this is like really clear as day memory. It was, I can tell you that 1993, it was in a science class, year 7 at school. I grew up in North London. And so our whole school was like hip hop and drum and bass. And that's what we were all into. It's weird because I've sort of grown up later and lots of mates sort of had Britpop in that era. But we were all fucking like jungle and shit. And but I remember a kid in our class called Carl Black, when I was meant to be listening to Iron's teacher. We sat at the back of the room, we listened to Doggy Style start to finish on his cassette player. And it just blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like that in my life. I'd never heard lyrics like that. I'd never heard beats like that. And that was it. That was just the word go.
From the depths of the sea, back to the black Snoop Doggy Dog, Monkey at the dot. Went solo on that ass, but it's still the same. Long Beach is the spot where I serve my cane. Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me, but don't lose your grip. 9 trizz ain't the years there for me to fuck up shit. So I ain't holding nuts back. And motherfucker, I got 5 on the 20 sack. It's like that.
And then basically through him and through other people at the school, it was in like Public Enemy and Cypress Hill, and kind of went from there, man. It was a proper, I mean, my parents were really unhappy that I was playing music with a lot of swearing and right. kind of misogynistic lyrics in it, but they, yeah, it just, I, yeah, it was a proper, it hooked you though.
Well, the thing is about that album is it is a great introduction to hip hop, because even if you don't like hip hop or you haven't listened to it before, it is one of the catchiest albums, mainly thanks to Nate Dogg, but like it is super like accessible if you put aside the fact that it's one of the most misogynistic records of all time. But like it is like yeah. super, you can get into it so easily, right? Like it's just, it's a, and it is packed with like classics, do you know what I mean? But the thing that always gets me about the album is Ain't No Fun is wow. I mean, that...
Yeah. But that's one of those tracks that I don't think I even thought about until probably only a few years ago. Like, I spent most of my teenage years listening to that, singing along to it, and then it suddenly clicked and went, oh, man, like, that is horrific stuff. but I think that with like a lot of the lyrics of hip-hop from all those, I don't know, from the early 90s, I think I rapped along to and just kind of, you know, listened to endlessly without knowing what was going into my head. At all.
Well,
just
it was
endless
a weird,
violence and
yeah it's a weird one, because like, you know, you talk about your parents not being happy. I mean, obviously for us that pushes it over in terms of something you want to listen to if your parents hate it and they think it's offensive. But at the same time, like, it felt so much different to like if you hear a record now with swearing in it, because like the boundaries have changed of what's offensive or whatever. I don't think you can have that again, do you know what I mean, where a record just absolutely has like that level of kind of shocking kind of misogyny. But I remember listening to it at the time not being shocked particularly, just thinking it was amazing. Yeah, bitches, man, fuck them hoes, do you know what I mean? Like, you're not listening going, this is yeah. offensive. You're just like, this is amazing, this is my life, this is what I'm like in Crawley, mate, do you know what I mean? Like, I've got no love for bitches.
I was sort of just thought that what I was hearing was about real life, like the life that yes. I wasn't seeing. You know, they were talking about Compton and drugs and stuff, and that's real. This is all real stuff that's happening. And I felt, you know, like I was getting a glimpse of that through it. It was, but I mean, all of that, it was that West Coast sound as well, man. I just never heard anything like that. And like the first Warren G album, the Regulate album, was, I thought that was amazing. You know, and the Chronic and all that kind of, with that, I don't know, I don't even know what it is that makes that kind of noise.
Yeah.
The gap, whatever it is. I've never known what instrument. If it's just a an NPC or whatever, isn't it? I've got a clue. But I want that in all songs, most songs.
Yeah, because there was that patch, wasn't there, when there was like Snoop and obviously Dre, and then Warren G came with that album, and all of those albums, the production is just, it still stands up today. You know, even if the lyrics don't, the production on that, if you heard a record with that in the back now, you'd be delighted, man. So just out of interest, you listen to Doggy Style, and then did you happen to immediately buy Snoop's next album, The Dogfather?
What was that 90, I'm trying to think when the second album came, was it 94 95? But like, you couldn't hear it before you bought it, so I had to go to our price and just shell out for it, so excited. And then like, I was one of the first people in my class to get it because I'd saved up for it, and we all listened to, like, several of us listened to it at once and went, oh, this is really disappointing. Like, what a waste of money that I didn't have.
Well, it was difficult.
But then I've had that with every album since that as well.
And the worst thing was this, I don't know if you remember this, but on the album, he's sort of going on about how he doesn't need a producer to make a great album, while making an album that really does reinforce that he does need a great producer to make a good album.
Yeah, absolutely. Was that the album with one Dre track on it, though? Or was that was a couple of albums later, wasn't it?
I think where he had like later, one... I can't remember, but yeah.
Yeah, there was one album, a few albums later, where he had like Vapors and other stuff, and he had one Dre track, and that one track stood out. Like, he should have just scrapped the entire rest of the album. I mean, he released that one album that everyone just still talks about now, and then to release, like, he's released something like 12 other albums, and all of them have been shit. Like, that's not even second album syndrome. That's, like, so much worse.
Well, what it turns out is, what we didn't realise is that Doggy Style was first album syndrome, and it's where basically he managed to pull out a great record. But I think, like, I don't know how much of his subsequent stuff you've listened to. Like, Last Meal, I don't know if you heard that, but that was okay.
Yeah.
Blue Carpet Treatment was, like, okay. Like, they've all got certain good bits on them, but I don't think he's put another stellar album out since, really.
No, I mean, he's had, like, Drop It Like It's Hot, and he had that From the Church to the Palace, which I think he's had. Like, there's no way of saying that without sounding like a dick, unless you say it like Snoop. Because you just said From the Church to the Palace. Like, you sound like an arsehole. But it's a good track. But that was Pharrell, wasn't it? So again, he needs someone good behind him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a marketing dream in terms of his voice and stuff like that. But, like, just, I remember, I think, and people can, like, tell me if they've got other contenders for this, but in terms of expectation to reality disparity, I think that might be the biggest example of that, man, because it was like, I was so hyped for that album. The only other one I can think of as I'm talking is, were you ever into Cannabis?
You know,
do you remember when his album came out and you just thought, oh, God.
Yeah, yeah, but there was a whole run of, like, acts like that. Then, like, Noriega had that first good album, and then what happened after that, and The Lox and all those kind of guys, it was sort of like that late 90s, early 2000s. Loads of people came out with all this kind of gusto, and like, and then they released one album and went, now I've got money, I've got nothing left. And it was just... they shouldn't have given them a big deal. They should have just given them a small deal and, like, gave them still a slightly shitty life.
Yeah,
so they had something more to talk about.
Hey, man, what's your favourite hip-hop album?
Do you have an album? I mean, it might be Doggy Style, but is there an album that you consider to be the greatest of all time, sort of a favourite hip-hop album?
That's hard, because there's several. Like, I mean, I don't know if it's the greatest of all time, so I wouldn't put it out there as that, but I fell in love with the Far Side Lab Cabin California when that came out, and I still listen to it far too often, which I know isn't like their famous one, but Lab Cabin California was this kind of jazzy Dilla beats that I hadn't heard before. And like, the first time I saw, do you ever see the video for Drop? Man, that's still amazing to this day. The fact they learned to rap the whole thing backwards so that when it was filmed and played backwards, it looked like they were rapping forwards. It's still one of the best things ever, and I love that. Let me freak the funk.
Obsolete is the punk that talk more junk than Sarah Sales. I jet propel at a rate that complicate the mental state as I invade the masquerade. They couldn't fade with the clipper blade. 10 years in the trade is not enough, you can't cut it. I let you take a swing and you butt it for an easy out. I leave him seized with doubt of exceeding. My name is Booty Brown and I'm proceeding.
I mean, the thing is, I've got like that, and I mean, like, Gangstar Moment of Truth is just unbelievable. Yeah. I still love 36 Chambers. It's very hard to pick one, but I mean, that's kind of thing, like, talking about, again, music today. Only recently it's been like Kendrick, and I can't think of many others that made that kind of impact on me in the same way. But yeah, it's hard to have a one album though.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's funny you said that about Far Side, because it's with that Lab Cabin. I remember that album sort of confusing people at the time, because they love, not confusing, that's an exaggeration, but everyone loved Bizarre Ride 2 so much that when Lab Cabin California came out, people were a little bit thrown, but they were like, oh, do I like this as much? But it is an amazing album. It's just, I think its initial release suffered from the expectations, like in the same way I guess Dogfather did, except Dogfather was actual shit. Yeah. But like, it sort of suffered from that. Another album that sort of, I don't know if you're a De La Soul fan, but do you remember when, were you into them when De La Soul is Dead?
And that really got, so do you ignored, remember when, didn't it? And compared to like, because everyone was just, it's not 3 feet high and rising. What's going on?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a good album.
It's so mad, because now it's a great album, and like that, and the Far Side's second album, like, I could go back to those and think they're great, but I remember at the time sort of going, oh, do I like this? I don't know. And then like, it's just because people were so in love with their first record that suddenly they just go, oh, people think they want more of the same, but they don't actually.
Yeah.
If they'd have come out with exactly the same album again, you'd have been like, oh, they're out of ideas. So it's like a tough one.
Tough, but then neither of them really recovered as well, because like the Far Side's album after that didn't really do, it was all right and they didn't really do very well, and then they all split up, and then De La kind of disappeared, and now their kind of biggest tracks are with Gorillaz, you know, in their crowdfunding albums.
Yes.
And it's really heartbreaking, because it's like they were inventive, they were being creative, you fucks, like, respect the artistry.
I know.
it's not enough for people, we want the same song again and again. It sums up society, doesn't it? Just fucking give us the same thing, please, endlessly, and we'll just die.
I know.
Miserable.
What sort of stuff are you listening to at the moment?
I don't know, quite a lot. I'm trying to really get back. Like, as I said, I'm sort of trying to really force myself to find stuff that my brother doesn't have to tell me about. I was really impressed with Little Sims opened for the Gorillaz the other week, and Frankie Boyle told me about her a few years ago, but I'd never really listened to her stuff. Like 23, and walked on stage like it was like, fuck this, I'm going to smash it. Like, just didn't give a shit. And she was just incredible. She's got a track called Dead Body that is just the sort of angry, like, rap that I really miss from like the kind of mid-90s. Shall I explain what the world done to me? You wouldn't understand where I've been, truthfully. And these dark thoughts never been new to me. Nobody loving me, everybody through me, everybody looking at me different, and nobody will listen. I can see you staring at me, what do you envision? No faith in me, should I resort to religion? But even I can never change the life I'm living, I'm a druggie, I'm a fiend. She's brilliant. And there's a lot of good UK ones. Yeah. I really love Koji Radical. He's I went to see him live. Again, that was one that my brother put me onto, because he's worked with him since. But I went to see him at the Jazz Cafe last year. And he was one of those performers that you just, like, you can't not watch him. Like, everything he did, the crowd was fixated on him. And when he just paused, everyone paused, and you know, the energy was insane. And he's just amazing, but he's got something more to him. Like, I think he was like a performance art student or something like that before he was a rapper, and he's just got this ability to carry himself. And do you know any Koji Radical at all?
Yes, I do. Yeah, mainly through your brother, actually, because your brother's done quite a bit of stuff for him recently. Like,
yeah,
but yes, I am a fan.
Yeah, there's a track called Kwame Nkrumah, which is kind of his famous track for his first album, 23 Winters. And when he performs that, like, he's got this way of like almost whispering it as it starts, and he kind of whispers it and whispers it, and it gets louder and louder and louder until it kind of builds, and then all the like the beats kick in, the drums kick in, and it's watching that live was like probably chills down my spine, like, shit, you're performing the crap out of this. It was beautiful. And you just felt the whole crowd like tense with it, and man, it was probably amazing.
Would it be selfish if I prayed for patience? When the only time I do is when my soul feels vacant. See blues in the muddy water, sing my sorrows in the truth. Is a poem still a poem if it's self-centered? Find I write just to center myself. See the proof, one breath out for relief. Another in, begin to vent, preach peace. Take a couple nines to the 1%. Oh, I must be. I was given no other option.
But yeah, there's a few bits. There's a really good... I found this person through Twitter. Again, just somebody retweeted it, but Lykelly47, and she's a US rapper, and she's got a track called Miss Me. And there's a few sort of female rappers coming out now that have got that kind of early Foxy Brown or early Lil Kim kind of anger to them, which I'm really liking, because I kind of miss... That was what I really liked, that really early days when... what was like Foxy Brown was like Married to the Firm and all that kind of fuck you kind of tunes, you know? And that's a really good track, that Lykelly47.
Charged up like a Tesla, out here messed up like a Mexican wrestler. This a gift from God, baby, I'm just a messenger. Elevate the flow, 47 gon' level up. Lord knows I've been through hell to put it on, so if I word on what mother trucker, then bring it on. Sometimes I can't believe I'm the one they was sleeping on. To each his own, I deserve a queen, you pick a thong, I'm sitting on.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That Little Sims, when Little Sims came out at, was it the O2 you said, right?
Yeah.
What were the crowd like? Because I think more so than for comedy, which is always my reference point, apologies, but like more so than for comedy, music support acts, it's fucking tough, right? Mm. To like to have a good gig in those circumstances, because people just don't give a shit about people they've not heard of, right? I mean, it's a tough one.
Yeah. Was she? I mean, she did really well. It was. I mean, the harder thing was it was like the O2. So what's that? That's like 20,000. Like for music gigs, it's standing something like 20,000 people. Anyway, she had it maybe half full, if that, because people hadn't turned up yet. And that room, when half full, you notice it's half full because it's really, really empty. There's a lot of space around. And she, I mean, she smashed it. What was quite nice, she's on a couple of Gorillaz tracks, so she got to come out later and play it to the full capacity, which was awesome. Right. But yeah, it's good. Did you ever hear that Ugly Duckling track called Opening Act that they did?
Which
summed that up. What is it? We're the opening act, we do a couple of songs, then we won't come back. And it's like, you won't stick around with the opening act. It's like, yeah, this sort of beautiful. But it's hard because I think with hip hop as well, especially like the opening act is often someone that's going to end up being, well, there's, what was the one years ago? Me and my brother went to see Gangstar. Like it was when they brought that album, like The Outlaws, or whatever, that they hadn't done an album for a little while. And
Yeah,
and the opening act for that was, what was her name? Was it Estelle or something?
Yeah.
And man, that was like just the wrong thing, because she was kind of poppy and hadn't really done much. And I think most of her stuff had been kind of just commercial radio, kind of hip hop. And this audience were hardcore Gangstar fans. And it was kind of like watching someone just play to really, that must be the most disappointed faces in that audience.
Well, the thing about Estelle is like, she did, like, you know, she was on the Black Twang album, stuff like that. And then she sort of, so she's a great rapper, but like when she blew up, it was sort of like you said, off that sort of poppy stuff. And like when you're going to see a Gangstar, who like you only hear DJ Premier talking when he says something about playing that real shit and fuck that pop stuff, then you know that the audience have got a certain like mentality. Do you know what I mean? Going into that gig, I mean, it's a hard one. I remember going to see Gangstar, and they brought out Freddie Fox, and they did Militia, and he started firing a super soaker into the crowd. And it sounds ridiculous, but I remember thinking it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. I mean, Freddie Fox with a super soaker on its own without any music or anything is amazing. But it just was like, you know, like when you're saying about Koji Radical, about just moments and performance and you just getting really into it, it becomes more than the original track. Do you know what I mean? It's just like when people really put the effort into putting on a show, it's fucking amazing.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I'd love to see the kind of Freddie Fox Super Soaker tour where he doesn't do any tunes. He just stands on the stage and just your heart just like soaks people. That'd be beautiful. There's something in that. It's that whole thing of like there's certain moments of like I have certain moments of certain gigs that just stick with me. And one of them was like that Gangstar gig where I just remember like Premier came on in a mask and everyone knew it was him, but they weren't sure. And he started scratching just Premier style and he started scratching and the crowd's getting like kind of, you know, people started to move a bit. And then Guru just runs on, tears off his shirt and starts shouting like, Big L, rest in peace. And everyone just kind of jumped up and down at the same time. And it was on those beautiful like, this whole room is a unit right now. It just felt amazing. It was so good.
Oh, good,
I will never get that with a comedy gig. That's never going to happen to me with comedy. It's like, I always think about, do you ever dream about like having a hype man for comedy? I always dream about having someone behind me that I'll do a joke and then they'll shout yeah and repeat the last line of my joke or something to get people chanting. One day it will work out. Yeah.
I went to see Chappelle at the Apollo and he had like a hip hop DJ beforehand, and I mean it's a bit different because like I think when Chappelle plays in the States, the audience sort of know, I mean the audience here know what he's about in the UK. I'm not sort of patronizing British comedy audiences, but Dave Chappelle is known as the comedy guy that's really into his music and stuff like that in the States, whereas here not so much people know him for his comedy. And like, so some people are a bit bemused, but loads of people are like super into it. Do you know what I mean? He's got a DJ out. And I thought, oh, that'd be great to do that. But then I just thought, I get nervous that people are just going to be more into that than when I come. Like, if they've heard a load of amazing tunes and then I come out and just moan about my family for a bit, who gives a shit? Like,
Chappelle's got that. Do you see Block Party? Block Party, where he's got where Mos Def's on the drums. And he's doing the jokes and Moses doing the drums. And I was watching that again. Yeah, I know. Well, exactly. I mainly complain about politics to grown-ups and they're going to be like, nah, shut up. Like, just play the beats. This is more miserable shit about the world being crap. Like, I want to hear a good track. Yeah, it's probably not a good idea.
I remember Paul McCaffrey saying, I can't remember which band it was he went to watch, but he went to Bath Comedia to watch a music gig. And he said that it was one of the most depressing experiences, seeing the response that people could get in that room. Do you mean knowing that he'd done like comedy sets in there, people had laughed or whatever, but he saw a music gig in there and it fucking went off. Do you know what I mean? He's just like, oh, it's the same space, but the reaction is very, very different. Do you know what I mean?
It's so. I mean, I always think that thing of like, you know, we struggle to write new material all the time as comedians, and then you watch a band play the song that people have been singing, you know, for the last 15 years and how nuts they go. And I'm like, oh man, I wish I could just do the first joke I wrote again. You know, maybe they just like to hear the same stuff again and again.
I know. I mean, I don't know if you find this on like when you, cause like you tour and stuff like that, but when you go and do a show with your stuff and then you've got like, you know, it's a new tour, the audience haven't heard it. And then you sort of fuck up a joke or you fuck up a bit and then you go, and the first time you hear a bit is the time that you remember as an audience member. Do you know what I mean? Like the first time is how you make your judgment because there's always diminishing returns after that. And I always hate it if I mess up a bit because I stumble on a word or I get the timing wrong. I think, right, well, that's how they're going to remember that forever. That's that bit ruined.
And they'll always talk about, oh, it wasn't as good as the last time. You'll become the Snoop Dogg of comedy. No one wants to be the Snoop Dogg of comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely deliver a dog father. I've never delivered the doggy style, though, so that's the thing. What are your favourite live gigs? Because we're always talking about live stuff on here. But and I also get abuse on Twitter because, not abuse, that's an exaggeration. I mean, I do get abuse on Twitter, but not about this. But like, I'm always saying that hip-hop live is always a bit of a disappointment, bar a few exceptions. Have you been to many good gigs?
Yeah, I've been to quite a lot of good gigs. But I'm trying, like... I'm not good at, especially not anymore. I can't go to the front of any of them. Like, I'm really good. Like, we bought tickets to see Kendrick in February. Right. And my wife's currently pregnant and due in March, which is very exciting. So fucking terrified. Yeah, thanks. But she's going to be 8 and a bit months pregnant when we see Kendrick and James Blake supporting, and we're worried the bass is going to induce labour. Like, we're certain it's going to happen on the top tier of the O2 or whatever. It's going to be awful. But it'd be the coolest baby in the world. But like, for that, I'm like, right, we've got seats. There's no way I'm going to be down. I mean, obviously my wife couldn't be in the standing anyway, but like, I don't want to be at the front of these gigs. I'm quite happy to sit and watch and enjoy from a distance now, I think. I think the problem with a lot of hip hop gigs, I don't have the energy to be at the front of you know, that of those kind of crowds.
It's a mission to be at the front of those gigs. I remember, like, when I used to go, I used to go to a lot more gigs than I go to now, but I used to go all the time and just force my way to the front on the off chance that one of them might give me a fist bump. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's insane. And then now I will get the furthest away seat that still allows me to have a clear view. Do you know what I mean? Like, why would you not want to be in a sofa or a comfortable chair? Yeah. I just don't understand.
Well, also, you
it.
Can get up and go to the toilet from there. Like, if you're stuck at the front, you can't go to the loo. You can't go get another drink because you're stuck at the front.
Yeah.
And you'll never, ever get back there. If you leave, you're never going back.
No.
Like, it's a one-way ticket.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I think there's, like, gig wisdom, isn't there? I think, like, once you've done a few gigs, you get the knowledge of how to do it properly in the future.
I know.
And you look at all the young people in the front going, idiots, you fucking idiots.
Yeah, I totally.
You're going to hate this. And I love it. But then you see them like exactly getting fist bumps. You're going, fuck, I've been there.
I
wish I was more naive.
Oh, man. Hip-hop gripes.
Is there anything that you... I mean, you sort of touched on it with the misogyny stuff. Is there stuff about hip-hop that you don't like and has made you, I don't know, decide to listen to other stuff for a bit or anything like that?
Would you know what put me off hip-hop for a long time was just auto-tune.
Right.
Like, it's such a petty thing, but... I don't hear you sound like a robot anymore. Like, California Love, way back in whatever 1996, fine.
Yeah.
And then everything since then can fuck right off if it's got auto-tune in it. There's something about it just makes you go, no, man, I want to hear your voice. Like, I like hearing people's hip hop voices. I don't want to hear you fucking, you know, if you can't sing, don't sing.
Yeah.
Don't get someone else to sing. Don't do your shitty auto-tune. I don't know, it just put me on. I mean, I never got into that. Like, you know, that was kind of the point with Kanye. Although I've come back to Kanye since.
Yeah.
But when he did that 808 and Heartbreak, like, I was like, no, I can't do that. You need to stop. It reminds me of that shit Cher song. Do you believe in love?
God,
that's what
yes.
it was. Just, you know, like...
Oh, my
I think
God.
She did it. Hip-hop artists shouldn't be doing it after she
that
did it.
That is such
you know?
A good shout, man. Jesus. Like, Cher cannot have an influence on hip-hop. No disrespect to her, but, like,
no.
You can't... You know, if hip-hop started taking all of their leads from, like, the Shoop Shoop song, you'd be fucked off. Do you know what I mean? So, why is auto-tune...
Oh,
right?
Man.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that.
Exactly.
And it's a weird one, isn't it? Because, like... You can do whatever you like in production. And then it felt weird that they go, well, if you can't sing, just auto-tune the shit out of it. And then you go, so what is required to be a music artist at this stage? I mean, I don't understand what you need to be able to do.
Because also, like, there's so much in, like, a good hip-hop voice. Like, Kendrick has it. I think Tyler, the Creator, has such a good kind of slightly gruff hip-hop voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, like, all the... I mean, like, you look at Q-Tip, who's got such a distinctive voice, or Charlie Tuna, or some people like that, where you go, you can recognise that voice instantly.
Yeah.
But if your hip-hop voice is auto-tuned to fuck, then you're taking away one of the best bits of why people would go listen to you. And also, what's that like live? Do you just... have it kind of, you know, have one of those that sort of tune the whole time. Like, that's shit. It's just shit.
Yeah.
It feels to me, I don't know. At the same time, the idea of doing, say, a comedy gig entirely auto-tuned does sound quite good. So,
yeah, I mean, know, I think that does actually sound good. I mean, the other thing that gets me is, like, you know, when they do the double up on the vocals, like so they do the verse and then they do the ad-libs off the back of it, and, like, you know, Eminem will do, like, oh, like, all this in the background of his verse. One of my pet peeves, oh my God, I can't believe I said peeve on a hip hop podcast. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But one of my things that really gets on my fucking tits, bruv, is when they double up the whole verse. So it sounds like two of them rapping for the whole thing. I don't know why, but it just feels like I just want to hear your voice on its own. Do you know what I mean? It's the same sort of thing as auto-tune.
Yeah.
I just don't want to hear you fuck with the verse too much, because then, like you said, then live it's a completely different proposition. Do you know what I mean?
But do you not find that with, like, there were certain albums as well, and this is when I'm gonna be crap and not remember any, but there's certain albums where they've got too many guests.
Oh my god,
because I'm like, no, I bought the album for you, I don't need to hear everyone else on it. I'd just like to hear you rap it. Now, a lot of the Wu-Tang guest albums, you know, a lot of the Wu-Tang solo albums had that, where it's like, well, if I wanted a Wu-Tang album, I'd buy the full Wu-Tang album. I've bought the solo album to just hear, you know, that solo artist. But every track has all the other Wu-Tang on it. It's like, come on, man. I don't know. I sort of feel like, again, it's cheating. It's like they're like, I'd like a solo album, but I can't be asked to write that much
material. Well, there's like a sort of a, there's two ways that hip hop seems to do featured artists. And one is, and there's a big craze for this, and it isn't so much now, but like where they would just get the hottest rappers to like do like 8 bars or 16 bars on like a track. And then you'd look at the album listing and it's like every single song was featuring some like popular rapper or whatever, and you'd be like, okay, I mean, I'm not that excited about this. I mean, don't get me wrong, every now and again a guest artist would come on and like absolutely murder it, like Busta Rhymes is very good for that, and obviously Eminem's very good at that, coming off the bench and then fucking destroying a track. But sometimes
it was early days of DMX, yes, was good as well, where you just have a track that was all right, and then you'd come and go, and you'd be like, uh-oh, it's going to actually be good for a second. Yeah. I can't
imagine what that feels like as the artist whose album it is, and then you've done what you think is good on a beat, and then you see someone come in and just fucking make it incredible, and it's like, oh, okay. Well, that is depressing. I'll have to try and figure out why I'm taking this off without offending him.
And that's it. And if people are like, their favourite moment of your album is someone else.
the other way that hip-hop artists go sometimes is they just get their flatmates to do guest verses. Do you know what I mean? I always remember thinking, and no disrespect to him, but I remember thinking, do you remember the Flavour in Your Ear remix with like...
Yeah.
With Biggie, LL Cool J, Busta Rhymes, and bizarrely, Rampage, the Last Boy Scout, like such a fucking weird inclusion on that track. And obviously, he's Busta Rhymes' cousin, I think. And so Busta's gone, listen, I'll give you that fire at the end, but you've got to let Rampage come on. I was like, don't get me wrong, Rampage's verse is fine. But I remember thinking, who the fuck is this guy? Like, everybody else is a bona fide legend. Do you know what I mean? And then you just got Rampage just come on. Okay, sweet, you won a competition to come on the track. Good for you, mate. Give it your best shot.
Yeah, did you ever listen to, like, any of the UK, like, Skits, UK hip-hop stuff, where he released a few years back, and he released, I think it was, I can't remember what Skits' first album was called, but it had, like, a track on it called Fingerprints of the Gods, and it was, like...
Yes, I remember that. And, I remember Fingerprints of the Gods, amazing.
Yeah, but then it had this guy, it had like Roots Maneuver, Philo Saver, and then it had this guy called Skeleton who just rapped a bit like that. I'm Skeleton. But he'd come in after like Roots Maneuver, Philo Saver just fucking killed it. And then this guy, God almighty, what the devil you start? What the hell, what an earth child, what the blood clot? I want the rascal, blossom, and all the beasts. I'm the blessing and the diamond and the famine and the feast. Just somebody had wandered into the studio and they hadn't being able to kick him out. It's really he's shit. It's so weird.
Look, listen, Tiernan, we're almost out of time. You have been a brilliant guest, but I do want to talk to you about your comedy career, because one of the things, obviously, if you haven't checked out Tiernan, he's a great comic, a firebrand, I think it's a fair word to use about you. One of the things that I find particularly interesting about you, apart from the brilliant stand-up, is your kind of work ethic and the way that you do things, because you have adopted this model of like doing specials or shows or whatever and then just selling them direct to the public. Sort of how did that kind of come about, and what's your sort of ethos with it?
Well, I mean, it's partly because no one else would sell them to the public, but I mean, if anyone's listening and would like to do it for me, feel free, man. I'm no, but it's partly because I'm really impatient. I'm really, I do like,
right,
you know, I write material. So I do a weekly podcast called, I'm going to shamelessly plug it if that's all right, but it's called Partly Political.
Go for it, of course.
Yes, yeah, so it's called Partly Political Broadcast, and it's I do gags about the previous week's politics, and I interview actual clever people about politics who know stuff. But the reason I do that is because I write those jokes every week, and often I'd get to a gig and they'd be out of date. And I'm right. like, I'm impatient. I want people to hear it as it's there. So I think similarly with shows and stuff, I just thought I want to have control over what I'm doing. And I've always kind of respected the comedians that just go out and go, right, fuck it, I'm doing this. This is I do this job so that people can hear the things that I'm pissed off about. So
yeah.
how do I get this to people as quickly as possible? So I've got I just recorded a few weeks ago my last solo show, which got one brilliant review and one terrible one. So nice. I think that makes it fine. And yeah, so that'll be coming out in a few weeks, hopefully.
And how do people get that? Is that just straight off your website?
It's going to should be straight off my website. They've changed how I set that up and I don't understand the computers, so it should be very soon. And also on Next Up Comedy, which is really good. It's like a Netflix for stand-up. And you can subscribe to it. I think it's £3.50 a month. They've got loads of good comedians, solo hours and stuff on there. So it's well worth a go.
Yeah, that is a great... It's a good one for, like, if you just want to watch... loads and loads of great stand-up. And also the other thing that's great about it is because, like, a lot of these comics they've got on Next Up won't be doing, like, extensive tours or whatever, it's a great, and you might not have got a chance to see them. There are brilliant comics that you just won't have seen, so it's a wicked website to go and check out.
Yeah, well worth it. And the first month is free, I believe, if I'm going to do a cheesy right? ad for it. I mean, it was. It might not be anymore. I've probably really, really damaged their reputation. Those people be looking on going, I heard on a podcast it was free. Nah, sorry, guys.
So when is that coming out? That'll be out next week, won't it?
It's good. It's just being finished edited now, so hopefully in a couple of weeks.
Do you sit in on the edits of these? Like, are you a control freak when it comes to that sort of thing?
Do you know, I don't want to be. I had to watch it all from start to finish the day for a sort of final cut thing, and it hurts. It hurts so much because I just sit the whole way through going, well, I said that like a dickhead, and that, why did I ruin that joke? That's a joke that really works if I didn't say it like that. And I spend the whole time, hey, I kind of want to tell them at the end, just fucking scrap it, it's shit. But, you know, it's just, are you like that, overcritical of your own?
Yeah, I mean, I first of all, I find it very difficult to watch full stop, and the only reason I ever watch anything I've done is because I have to for the edit. But I remember, like, my last show, we did the recording of it, like, midway through the... like, maybe two-thirds of the way through the tour. And, like, as you know, you change stuff all the time. Do you know what I mean? Or you get bored of a bit, or you change the wording of it, or you add stuff to stuff. So then by the time I was watching the edit, it was near the end of the tour, and I just thought, oh, I've done that so much. I do that better now, and this bit is... crap, like compared to how I'm doing it now. You just have to accept it, that when you're recording something, that is it, and you do the best you can at the time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's also that thing of, like, if it's towards the end of a tour, like, I'm bored of that material by the time I've said it so many times. I'm like, oh, this fucking joke again, great. You know, it's not like I don't know how this one ends again, like, it's just it gets so tedious. We're killing the magic for anyone that now wants to see anything we do.
If you see Tiernan and I ever, just remember that we're dead behind the eyes and we don't give a fuck about any of
the stuff. we're far into Dogfather stage. That's what it is.
Listen, man, you've been an amazing guest. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
Thanks tons for having me, man. It's been a pleasure.
No worries. Make sure you check out Tiernan's comedy and his podcast, and we'll see you soon. Thanks, Tiernan.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.